Good morning. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, with today's Wall Street Journal. Weaker dollar in focus, political uncertainty in Japan and France linger. The U.S. dollar likely to weaken again as the Fed's rate-cutting cycle nears and questions linger over the politicization of the central bank, says Paul Mackel, global head of FX research at HSBC. A weaker than expected jobs report raises the risk that U.S. labor conditions are shifting from cooling to deteriorating and that the Fed may need to cut rates faster, he says. Still broad USD weaknesses could be tempered by political uncertainty in Japan after Prime Minister Ishibe's resignation and in France where Prime Minister Bayrou's government is set to collapse, raising the likelihood of snap elections, he adds. Few reasons to be long JPY and Ishibe aftermath. Japan's PM Ishibe's exit shifts focus to his successor and what, if anything, that means for political stability, writes Chris Weston at Pepperstone. The market will weigh the extent of additional fiscal measures and budgets under a new leadership. The degree of fiscal impulse will be important in containing upside and long-ending JGBs. These developments will likely be seen as yet another reason to push the Bank of Japan's next 25 BP hike into 2026, he says. The expectation is already in play with swaps traders pricing only 12 BPS of hikes by December, and Weston points to that as yet another reason why few want to own JPY at present. He looks for JPY weakness in Asia to become broad-based. USD JPY last at 148.24. US. Hyundai raid rattles a hot spot of growth in Georgia. Koreans drawn to communities around the carmaker's complex now wonder if they are welcome. Some locals say the factory hasn't lived up to promises, by Rachel Wolf. When Governor Brian Kemp signed a $5.5 billion manufacturing deal with Hyundai Motor Group, Georgia celebrated as the latest economic development project in state history. Georgia gave the carmaker $2 billion in tax breaks, and in return, Hyundai's new electric vehicle megafactory would give the Savannah region an economic boost. In the suburb of Pooler, that promise seemed already to be coming true. The population shot up 22% just 2020 and 2024, according to census estimates, to around 31,000. Demographic data lags behind, but community leaders estimate half of that growth has come from Koreans. Suddenly, the single Korean restaurant in town had to compete with around half a dozen others. The newly opened Costco, local said, started carrying kimchi, dried seaweed, and mandu dumplings. New homes sprung up by the dozens, and Korean families moved into planned neighborhoods, with streets named Blue Moon Crossing and Harvest Hill. Many of the newcomers worked at the factory, a massive site that was still expanding with new construction in rural Ellabelle, about 20 minutes away. On Thursday, federal agents raided the complex, arresting nearly 500 people for alleged immigration violations, most of them Korean. On Sunday, the Korean government said it had reached a deal with the U.S. to bring its people home. The raid and its fallout shocked the auto industry in South Korea. Nowhere is that shock more apparent than in a place like Pooler, where a new Korean community had taken root. Some said they felt betrayed by the raid, especially after Korean companies made such a massive investment in the U.S. Others said they believe that improperly documented workers have brought undue scrutiny upon those who are here illegally. You can feel the tension, said 51-year-old Hoosung Kim, an American citizen and local pastor, also known as Robin. Like many Korean immigrants, Kim took an American name to fit in better with American culture. That effort to assimilate, Kim said, is common among Korean immigrants and part of the way they see themselves. Proud of their culture and origins, and proud to be welcomed by Americans as hard workers who bring value to the country. The raid shattered that image and left many feeling suddenly fearful and angry. Many spent the weekend worrying about their futures in the U.S. and arguing over who to blame. We've worked hard, built businesses, created jobs here, read one message in a sprawling group chat of Koreans living in the area. And instead of support, it feels like we're being pushed out. Kim's phone lighted up every few seconds with messages from the roughly 1,400 person group chat for Savannah area Koreans on KakaoTalk, Korea's WhatsApp equivalent. His wife, who chose the name Hannah when she naturalized, is in another chat group about 1,500 Koreans strong. Neither of them is sure why there are two seemingly identical chats. Pat Wilson, commissioner of the Georgia Department of Economic Development, recently hailed Georgia's decades-long partnership with Korea in an opinion piece in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Some 100 Korean-owned facilities operate in Georgia, employing more than 17,000 people as of last year, Wilson wrote, noting that Korea ranked as Georgia's third-largest total trade partner, with more than $17.5 billion in goods traded. Korea is not just a friend, but a key pillar of Georgia's global economic strategy, he wrote. But not everyone is convinced that the relationship has been beneficial for the state. Barry Ziegler, the chief business manager of Local Union 188, which represents plumbers, pipefitters, welders, and air conditioning technicians, said he was furious after around 65 union members were let go from the battery plant several months ago. They had been hired to install mechanical piping by two separate subcontractors. We went out there and did a great job. No fatalities, no injuries, and then we just got replaced by the undocumented workers, said Ziegler, who has been in the union for 27 years. It was a kick in the knee. Tory Branham, who is running for the May Republican primary for one of the Georgia's U.S. congressional seats, said she alerted the Department of Homeland Security to undocumented workers at the site. It couldn't be determined what role that might have played in the raid. DHS didn't immediately respond to a request for a comment. She thinks the plant isn't as much of an economic boon for Georgia as the governor has claimed, and that trained, unionized U.S. workers have been passed over in favor of cheaper, undocumented labor. We gave tax cuts for jobs for Georgians that never happened, said Branham. The site includes Hyundai's EV factory and a battery factory that is a joint venture between the South Korean companies Hyundai and LG Energy Solution. The automaker said Friday it is assigning an executive to oversee the entire site and that it aims to ensure that all contractors and subcontractors follow the law. A spokesperson for the governor said state law enforcement coordinated with federal officials to provide all necessary support for this operation. Outside Costco, Kim Sun Jun and Sun Woon Young said they were saddened by the raid. The couple arrived from Korea 2 years ago for Sun to work as an engineer at the Hyundai plant. We have a need for Korean people's labor, and the U.S. doesn't make it easy, Sun said through the translation of his wife. The 57-year-old said that many of Hyundai's machines require Koreans to program them, and that work visas can take months to come through. Meanwhile, they are rushing to get the plant finished in time. We want a strong relationship between Korea and the U.S., he said. Jimmy Choi, a Korean-American software engineer, had traveled from Atlanta to spend a few weeks working on an IT project for Hyundai, but the 45-year-old was waiting Saturday to see if work would resume. Working hard every day and finishing everything in time, that is the Korean culture and mindset, and the U.S. benefits, said Choi. Still, he said, it is a complicated situation. I can see both sides, he said. Ming Chao Cho, a U.S. permanent resident who came to America for boarding school when he was 13, thinks the arrest could make assimilation harder. The 29-year-old was already worried that he wouldn't be allowed back in the U.S. after going home to visit his family. I did it the right way, spending the money and time, said Cho, who worked for a logistics company unaffiliated with the plant. And I know there are a lot of people like me. For the pastor and his wife, the raid couldn't have come at a worse time. Pooler is their American dream, and they are betting big on it. Both Robin and Hannah Kim came to the U.S. as young adults, Robin for divinity school, and Hannah as a teenager with her family. Hannah became a citizen in 1996 and Robin in 2021. The couple moved from P to Pooler from an army base 45 minutes away, where Robin was stationed as a Christian chaplain. They landed on Pooler because they thought they had a lot to offer to new immigrants, including the free English classes they have been teaching twice a week. Just last month, the couple bought their first home. The house, with its white columns, tidy green front lawn, white quartzite countertops, and engineered white floors, is the picture of middle-class suburban America. Robin is starting a Korean-American bilingual church. "We were doing great until that incident happened," he said. "Now there's a risk that people will make assumptions or generalize unfairly." His friends have already told him that they felt, for the first time, like they are being watched or judged, even if they're here legally and have nothing to do with the situation. "Those who come over for roughly 2 to 5 year contracts," Hannah said, "are so eager to learn English, and they are so happy that their kids are having opportunities to attend American school." But the English class Hannah, a 58-year-old mental health counselor, normal. A lot of people, her husband said, are trying to keep a low profile now. Economy. China's export momentum slows, missing expectations. Outbound shipments rose 4.4% from a year earlier in August, down from a 7.2% increase in July. China's exports grew at a slower than expected pace last month as the boost from a trade truce with the U.S. waned. Outbound shipments rose 4.4% from a year earlier in August, down from a 7.2% in July, the General Administration of Customs said Monday. Economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal export growth of 5.2%. Chinese imports climbed 1.3% during the month, according to the Customs Bureau. That compared with July's 4.1% increase and the 1.8% rise expected by the economists surveyed. That led to a trade surplus of $102.3 billion, up from $98.25 billion in July and beating the $101.4 billion forecast by economists. UK. Is the UK a canary in the coal mine for a heavily indebted world? Borrowing costs are surging for many industrialized countries, causing talk of a possible crisis. By Max Colchester and Ed Ballard. This past week, UK long-term borrowing costs hit their highest level in decades, causing Treasury Chief Rachel Reeves to shoot down suggestions that the heavily indebted country is heading for a fiscal crisis. Most economists agree with her for now, but in a world where industrialized nations have taken on record amounts of debt and are paying ever more to finance the borrowing, the UK could become the financial market's equivalent of the proverbial canary in the coal mine, a leading indicator of trouble for other debtors like the US and France, economists say. "The UK isn't alone in all of this," said Ruth Gregory, Deputy Chief UK Economist at Capital Economists. "There is a common theme across many G7 countries that the conditions do seem to be in place for potential fiscal crisis, although that doesn't mean a crisis is imminent or inevitable." Last year, the British Labour government announced the biggest tax hike in a generation, billed as a one-off effort to plug a widening shortfall in public finances and reassure investors that the UK was a country serious about balancing its books. But now Reeves is expected to return in November to ask British taxpayers for billions more in taxes. The reason? The UK's borrowing costs keep rising, its economy isn't growing as fast as hoped, and the government, despite having a healthy majority in Parliament, has struggled to cut ballooning welfare spending. Economists worry the pattern could keep repeating. Over the past 2 decades, governments went on a debt binge, fueled by low interest rates. Now that rates have risen, investors worry that Western governments aren't willing to make politically difficult decisions to curb public spending, leaving politicians caught on a hamster wheel of ever higher taxes. France's government is expected to fall in the coming week amid political opposition to proposed spending cuts and the elimination of 2 public holidays. A move to raise tax revenues from 2 more working days. The amount of debt as a percentage of annual economic output in advanced economies has doubled since 2007 to around 80%, according to the International Monetary Fund. The IMF says public debt could rise close to 100% of the global economy by the end of the decade, in part because of rising interest costs. In the last year, net interest payments on government debt across the globe rose 11.2% to $2.72 trillion, partly driven by stubbornly high inflation that keeps interest rates high. The UK isn't the most indebted Western country, nor is it the slowest growing. Unlike the US, however, it doesn't have a major reserve currency. And unlike its European neighbors, it isn't part of a currency club with a big central bank that helped engineer bailouts of debt-laden countries. It also has a recent history of market turmoil when the pound crashed in 2022 after then Prime Minister Liz Truss signed off on an unfunded tax cuts combined with big borrowing. Truss was ejected from Downing Street within 6 weeks. Investors now demand a slight premium to lend to the UK, whose borrowing costs have risen sharply in recent years, partly as a result of persistently high inflation. Yields on 30-year government bonds, or gilts, this past week hit levels last since in the last 90s, rising higher than those of France, which has a bigger debt load. The yield on a UK 10-year debt is now the highest in the group of seven nations, eclipsing the US. There are countries that have gotten higher debt levels or higher deficits, but when you look at what you're having to spend in terms of borrowing costs, that's where it becomes problematic, said Mark Dowding, Chief Investment Officer for Fixed Income at RBC Blue Bay Asset Management. Next year, the UK's interest payments are expected to hit 111.2 billion pounds, or roughly $150 billion, twice what the country spends on defense. UK government debt, currently below 100% of gross domestic product, is projected to hit 270% of GDP by the early 2070s, pushed up by an aging population and spending on health care and pensions, according to the country's fiscal watchdog, the Office for Budget Responsibility. This combination has turned the UK into a potential tinderbox, where a market crisis, either at home or abroad, could trigger yields to jump up further, said Gregory of Capital Economics. Some argue that precisely because the Bank of England is independent and unlikely to bail out the government, the country will be a first mover in facing up to the reality of its borrowing glut since the pandemic. It's going to be a mess, it's going to be painful, but the UK will at least confront the problem, said Robin Brooks, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Others might not until there is a crisis. As things stand, an immediate repeat of the trust market meltdown is unlikely, said Francis Diamond, head of European rates strategy at JP Morgan. The pound has risen against the dollar over the past year, a far cry from the steep falls seen under Truss or when the country was bailed out by the IMF in the 1970s. But the overall trend isn't positive. The Labour government elected last year vowed to be fiscally responsible, but its first efforts this year to trim the growth in welfare spending were knocked back by its own lawmakers in Parliament. In July, Reeves appeared tearful in Parliament after plans to make a modest welfare cut were abandoned as Labour's own lawmakers threatened a rebellion. A plan to cut a fuel subsidy to the elderly also had to be shelved. That, say economists, leave Reeves with a very difficult balancing act when she presents spending plans this fall, finding a way to raise taxes but not crush growth. World: China shows unity with Russia and North Korea, but divisions linger. Xi's embrace of Putin and Kim sent a powerful message, but those relationships remain, for now, far short of a military or political alliance, by Yaroslav Tromanov. The pageantry of China's Xi Jinping, flanked by leaders of fellow nuclear powers Russia and North Korea, as intercontinental ballistic missiles rolled through flag-waving crowds on Tiananmen Square marked a new phase in the redrawing of the international order. No longer circumspect about supporting his two rogue neighbors, Xi flaunted Beijing's growing links with Moscow and Pyongyang, both of them subjected to Western sanctions, both of them engaged in a bloody war against Ukraine, and both of them potentially useful to China in a possible conflict with the US. Despite becoming p tighter, those relationships remain, for now at least, far short of an actual military or political alliance that could impose its will on the Eurasian landmass, the world's wealthiest and most populous region. China is very cautious about working with these two countries. Unlike what is depicted in the West as them being allies, China is not in the same camp. Its view of warfare and security issues is very different from theirs, said Tang Xiaoyang, chair of the Department of International Relations at Tsinghua University, pointing out that Beijing hasn't fought a war for more than 4 decades. What China wants is stability on its borders. The gap between Beijing's aspirations and those of its junior partners, however, is clearly narrowing, Western diplomats and China watchers say. How fast and to what extent those contradictions could be bridged will determine the shape of the international system that is emerging after President Trump upended Washington's network of alliances in Asia and Europe. China is becoming less discreet about being seen as part of the so-called axis of upheaval. Prompted by intensifying China-US competition, China wants to show that, contrary to America's alienation of allies, it is better capable of uniting friends around itself, said Tang Zhou, a senior fellow with the Carnegie China think tank. China sees an opportunity to assert its own leadership when the U.S. is undermining its international credibility. Wednesday's parade in Beijing, which showcased China's expanding military might and its increasing confidence in being able to win a conventional war against the U.S., followed a regional summit in the city of Tianjin, which was also attended by Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Xi used this summit to propose a vague but ambitious plan for a new global governance initiative that would create a more just and equitable international order, an order that is no longer dominated by the U.S. The solidifying view among many in Beijing is that the current disarray in Washington and the rifts among the world's leading democracies have handed China a unique chance, making it less necessary for Beijing to worry about the diplomatic fallout of getting too close to pariahs such as Russia and North Korea. China and Russia have a very strong shared understanding of how the new international order should work. We think that the American hegemony is ending, and that's an objective reality. It's happening whether you recognize it or not, said Wang Dong, a professor at the School of International Studies of Peking University in Beijing. Both sides, Russia and China, see their relationship as one of strategic importance, and not only because of an increase in animosity coming from Washington. Clear limits to that bond remain, said Jinbo Wu, Dean of the Institute of International Studies at Fudan University in Shanghai. Neither Russia nor China want to be involved in a major conflict where the other one is involved. If we had a major conflict with the US over the Taiwan issue, I don't think Russia will come to our assistance, he said. We're good friends, good partners, but that's it. We will never become allies. Chinese officials stress that Beijing isn't sending actual weapons to Russia, doesn't recognize Russian claims on Ukrainian territory, and doesn't approve of North Korean participation in the conflict. Yet the images of Xi in his Mao-style tunic leaning toward North Korean leader Kim Jong-un or Russian President Vladimir Putin with explanations as some of the world's deadliest weapons rolled by undermine those assurances. The presence of Kim sent a message that China really stands by Putin and Russia's war in Ukraine. It means that the fact of Kim sending troops to fight Ukraine did not cause China any serious discomfort, said Steve Tsang, director of the SOAS China Institute in London. Inviting Kim was like a middle finger at the democratic West, saying that what you define as unacceptable is not something that we need to give a damn about. China's military is learning from the Russian experience against Western weapons systems in Ukraine, and some Western officials say that China has given tacit approval for North Korean participation in the war so that Pyongyang could modernize and upgrade its own arsenal, a potential boon to Beijing in case of a multi-front war against the West. While China's economic ties with North Korea are negligible, Russia and China had a bilateral trade of $245 billion last year, a volume that shrank by 8% during the first 7 months of this year after several months of rapid growth. Virtually the entirety of Russian exports is made up of oil, gas, and raw materials, while China provides Russia with its industrial output, including indispensable components for the Russian military industries. Being the two biggest powers of Eurasia, we cannot ignore current challenges and threats, be it on the scale of our common continent or of the entire world, Putin said in an interview with China's Xinhua state news agency ahead of his visit to China. China said it was abolishing visa requirements for Russian citizens during Putin's visit, a liberalization already in force for most European and many Asian nations, aiming to bolster trade and tourism. Putin said Russia will reciprocate. If Beijing's Ruitan shopping center, once buzzing with Russian shoppers, halls are deserted nowadays. We used to have a lot of business before the war, but now the Russians stop coming because they don't have any money, and when they do, they have a hard time taking it out because of the sanctions, said Zhang Dun, who sells leather jackets and coats. A store selling Chinese tea, retail and wholesale, saw its business halve since the start of the war in Ukraine, echoed attendant Zhang Lili. How can the Russians be coming here, visiting and spending money if there is a war in their country? In another Beijing mall, an empty store stocked Russian food, from salt to chocolates, for Chinese clients. A poster showed Putin eating ice cream atop a freezer with brands such as Stars of the Kremlin. Most of the customers come here to ask for Putin's favorite ice cream flavor, said attendant Lina, but there aren't many now. Beijing's bond with Moscow isn't cost-free. China's relationship with most European nations, a much more important source of technology and trade, has suffered as a result of Beijing's propping up the Russian war effort. It's very unfortunate that China-Europe relations are being kept as a hostage of this war, said Da Wei, director of the Center for International Security and Strategy at Tsinghua University. This is a price that China has paid for the war, which is not wanted by China and not supported by China. While debate on most political issues isn't permitted in the tightly controlled Chinese society, a variety of views remain tolerated on Russia and the war in Ukraine, with some prominent scholars publicly voicing support for Kyiv's resistance. One of China's leading strategists, Shi Yinghong, a distinguished professor at Renmin University, said that both Russia and North Korea, because of their adventurous behavior on the world stage, are creating risks for Beijing, especially as China faces economic headwinds. One major liability now comes from the guy who is still waging his war in Europe, and a second liability comes from the guy who has for many years escalated his development of nuclear missiles against all UN Security Council resolutions and now also sent massive troops to Europe to help Russia fight the war, she said. China's leadership believes that it would be against Beijing's interest for Putin to lose the war in Ukraine, a belief that Foreign Minister Wang Yi recently expressed to his European interlocutors, but it isn't clear at all that China would find it beneficial for Russia to win, achieving Putin's war aims of turning Ukraine into a vassal state and possibly asserting a European sphere of influence beyond Ukraine. If Russia were to win, it would become more troublesome to China than now when it is at war. It would have much less dependence on China's economy, and if the Republican Party remains in the White House after Trump, Russia would have a bigger chance for rapprochement with Washington, and China would have to worry about that, she added. Trump's current attempt to split Russia away from China don't elicit much angst in Beijing because of calculations that Putin wouldn't put much faith into promises by a White House that is so erratic and unpredictable, a view shared by many Russian analysts. Much of Xi's foreign policy over the past decade has been guided by a plan for national rejuvenation. You're listening to The Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, that would overcome the legacy of the century of humiliation. When China was torn apart by predatory colonial powers, reclaiming the Chinese state's control over Taiwan is a central part of that idea. Yet the one remaining major legacy of past colonialism is the annexation of large parts of China by Russia, areas that make up the sparsely populated Russian Far East region. That history still colors Chinese perceptions of the relationship with Moscow. Russia took the largest piece of land from China during the Qing Dynasty. In modern history, during the era of humiliation, China suffered mostly from two countries. One is Russia, the other is Japan. People still have vivid memories of the past, and it's very difficult to forget, said Wu of Fudan University. Yet the message from China's leadership isn't to dwell on that history, at least not now. We know what happened in the past, but we want to focus on the future, said Victor Gao, president of the Center for China and Globalization think tank in Beijing. The whole country is very much geared toward Russia-China cooperation. U.S. Chicago on edge after threats of ICE raids. President Trump threatens the city with Chipocalypse Now and mass deportations. By Joseph Pisani, Joe Barrett, and Alyssa Luckpot. Chicago was bracing over the weekend for a possible immigration crackdown after President Trump said he would deploy federal troops in the country's third largest city to conduct mass deportations. Trump has threatened for weeks to send the National Guard to Chicago, calling the city a mess that needed a federal intervention to fight crime. On Saturday, the president posted a meme on social media riffing off the Vietnam War movie Apocalypse Now with the phrase Chipocalypse Now. I love the smell of deportations in the morning, it said, along with a digitally altered photo of the president in front of the Chicago skyline with helicopters overhead and ablaze behind him. Chicago about to find out why it's called the Department of War, the Post continued, a reference to Trump's recent executive order to change the name of the Department of Defense to the Department of War. Democrats condemned the messaging. The President of the United States is threatening to go to war with an American city. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, a Democrat, responded on social media. This is not a joke. This is not normal, he wrote. Illinois won't be intimidated by a wannabe dictator. When Trump was asked on Sunday if he was threatening a war with Chicago, he said, "We're not going to war. We're going to clean up our cities." Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth, a Democrat, said Sunday on CBS News that she didn't have any indications of preparations to send federal troops into Chicago. Trump has deployed troops to Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., saying he is trying to make those places safer. Democratic leaders and others have questioned the use of military power on U.S. soil. Meanwhile, the Department of Homeland Security said this weekend it was stepping up raids in Massachusetts, targeting immigrants with criminal records. The latest moves alarmed immigrants in Chicago, keeping them home during a month when celebrations for Mexico's independence usually fill the streets. In the Pilsen neighborhood, which is largely Hispanic, police closed off streets for the annual Mexican Independence Day parade on Saturday. Normally, the event is a joyful one, with residents packing the sidewalks. This time, few people turned out. People are scared, and rightfully so, said Ramon Muniz, a 68-year-old retired bricklayer from Puerto Rico. He and others were distributing orange whistles for residents to use if they saw any immigration and customs enforcement activity at the parade or elsewhere. Other events were canceled because of possible immigration raids, including El Grito, a two-day festival in Chicago's Grant Park. It had been planned for next weekend. It was a painful decision, but holding El Grito Chicago at this time puts the safety of our community at stake, organizers say. Hundreds of protesters gathered in downtown Chicago on Saturday, holding up signs that said "ICE out of Chief" and chanting "Immigrants are welcome here." Pritzker warned residents to be careful while at any events and told them to protest if they can. "Pull out your phone, video everything they are doing," he said of any ICE agents they might encounter. The governor vowed to sue if troops are sent to the city. "That's going to be our first line of defense," he said. The Department of Homeland Security recently asked a naval base near Chicago to make room for Homeland Security officials. The agency asked to stay about a month at Naval Station Great Lakes starting September 5th. On Tuesday, a federal judge ruled that the Los Angeles deployment of troops earlier this year in response to immigration raid protests violated a 19th-century law prohibiting the use of federal forces for domestic labor enforcement. 2 days later, the District of Columbia's attorney general said he was suing to end the deployment of National Guard troops in Washington. Oil tycoons bet big on Trump. It's paying off. Administration opens land to drilling and moves to roll back environmental restrictions and hobble renewable energy, but crude prices have dropped. By Benoit Morin and Josh Dawsey. Oil billionaire Harold Hamm high-fived Donald Trump on election night as results trickled in at Mar-a-Lago watch party. Hamm, founder of family-owned oil and gas company Continental Resources, had good reason to celebrate. He and other oilmen had donated tens of millions of dollars to help re-elect Trump, betting his pro-fossil fuel agenda would stave off a long-term shift away from fossil fuels and keep the country hooked on gasoline. The wager is paying off. The Trump administration is opening swaths of wilderness land and federal waters to drilling, approving new terminals to export natural gas, and proposing to axe environmental regulations, including an Obama-era rule used to curb emissions from power plants, tailpipes, and oil and gas production. His one big beautiful bill is expected to hobble renewable energy projects and stunt the adoption of electric vehicles. Oil executives now enjoy extraordinary access to the White House. Trump has taken to phoning oil bosses whose TV appearances he enjoys, such as Chevron CEO Mike Wirth, according to White House and industry officials. "No doubt this administration understands how important energy is," said Toby Rice, CEO of natural gas producer EQT. Rice and ExxonMobil CEO Darren Woods sat at Trump's table during a July energy summit in Pittsburgh. So far, however, the industry's policy wins haven't flowed through to the company's bottom lines. Trump's shifting positions on trade, coupled with an increase in crude supplies globally, have depressed oil prices, cost energy firms billions of dollars in stock market value, and contributed to layoffs across the industry. And new tariffs on steel and aluminum are making drilling more expensive. U.S. oil prices are hovering near $62 a barrel, below the break-even point for many of the industry's smaller players, down from about $76 the week Trump took office. Yet some oil bosses see the turbulence as a price worth paying to see the president implement their agenda. White House spokeswoman Caroline Leavitt said the oil and gas industry is the backbone of the American economy and the source of millions of good-paying jobs, and that the president is delivering on his promise to make American energy dominant again. Trump's unabashed support for the industry has left environmentalists aghast. They contend the administration's moves will translate into higher energy prices for consumers, fuel climate change, and make the U.S. less competitive with other nations that are embracing renewable energy. Big ass. Hamm, Energy Transfer Executive Chairman Kelsey Warren, and Liberty Energy's then CEO Chris Wright, now Trump's Energy Secretary, were some of the top oil executives who hosted fundraisers for Trump during the campaign. Among other things, they wanted the next president to open up new markets by supporting new pipelines and terminals, to end subsidies for electric vehicles, and to kill tailpipe emissions regulations. Before the election, Warren told investors he was banking on finally completing Lake Charles LNG, a Gulf Coast terminal his company had sought to build for more than a decade. Warren donated more than $13 million to Trump's bid. After Trump became president, he lifted a pause former Joe Biden had imposed on new LNG exports, and the Energy Department last month granted the project a permit extension that the previous administration had denied. Warren and his company each gave $12.5 million after the election to the Trump-aligned MAGA Incorporated Super Political Action Committee. Trump's tax and spending legislation will end subsidies of up to $7,500 for purchasing or leasing an EV. It also brings a windfall to oil and gas and other companies in the form of expanded tax breaks. ConocoPhillips, EOG Resources, Occidental Petroleum, and Devon Energy recently told investors that because of new tax provisions in Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill, they collectively expect to save more than $1.2 billion in tax payments in 2025 and likely billions more in the coming years. British giant BP, which operates in the U.S., said the tax savings would likely offset any pressure from tariffs. Although large producers such as Exxon and Occidental Petroleum have acknowledged that climate change is a major global problem, administration officials have said global warming isn't a serious threat. In July, the Environmental Protection Agency said it aims to rescind a 2009 climate rule that states that greenhouse gases threaten public health and welfare by raising global temperatures. The agency has used the funding to regulate releases from power plants, motor vehicles, aircraft, landfills, and oil and gas activities. The Domestic Energy Producers Alliance, an industry lobbying group co-founded by HAM, praised the EPA's proposed revision of the rule, which the lobbying group called the foundation for nearly all environmental challenges facing U.S. oil and gas. Environmental groups have vowed to fight the move in court. Open doors. HAM and other top oil executives gathered on inauguration day for brunch and mimosas on the roof of the Hay Adams Hotel overlooking the White House. As they watched the president deliver his speech, one of them called out, "He just said, 'Drill, baby, drill.'" Others clapped and cheered. The industry has had rockier relations with the Biden White House. That administration had urged the industry to reduce emissions and embrace low carbon technologies, and Biden had accused oil companies of war profiteering after Russia's invasion of Ukraine sent oil prices and corporate profits soaring. The joke among some oil CEOs back then was that their only way into the White House was through the basement. The American Petroleum Institute, the industry's biggest oil lobby, couldn't get a meeting with Biden. When Biden and Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm appeared at an API meeting via video, recalled one attendee, "She told us we had to change or we'd be like Kodak," referring to the photography company upended by the advent of digital cameras. It has become a legendary story in the industry, the Kodak story. Trump first met with API and oil and gas executives in March at the White House. He told them it was his favorite industry and that there would be no tariffs on energy, according to people who attended. 2 weeks later, when Trump announced global tariffs on Liberation Day, oil and gas products were exempt. Since then, API has met with Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, Energy Secretary Wright, U.S. Trade Representative Jamieson Greer, and other administration officials. At least a dozen oil executives, including HAM, Exxon's Woods, and former Hess CEO John Hess, have spoken to Trump by phone since the election, according to people in the industry. Many CEOs have Wright's phone numbers, according to industry lobbyists. "It has been a complete turnaround from our interactions with the Biden administration," said Mike Summers, who leads API. "We outlined a clear policy roadmap well before the last election, and they've advanced those issues at every turn." Most of the oil companies and executives named in this article didn't respond to requests for comment. Early last year, HAM brought Wright, then still head of oil field services company Liberty Energy, to an energy roundtable at Mar-a-Lago. Then candidate Trump went around the room asking questions. Ham later recalled at an energy conference that Trump was so impressed by Wright's answers that he asked Wright to head out to DOE, referring to the Energy Department. Trump later attended a fundraiser at Wright's house in Montana, telling an aide it was among the nicest he had ever seen. In April, after Wright became Energy Secretary, he attended a gathering in Oklahoma City arranged by Ham to discuss the need for more energy to support the rise of artificial intelligence. So too did Burgum, EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin, and Secretary of Agriculture Brooke Rollins. Attendees joked at how many officials from the administration showed up separately. Burgum, Wright, and Zeldin have been zipping around the country to visit fossil fuel producing regions, talking up energy projects in Alaska, Louisiana, and Pennsylvania. At least a dozen former oil executives and lobbyists have joined the administration and are helping to oversee the nation's public lands and mineral resources. The National Energy Dominance Council, a body Trump set up to produce more American energy, is partly staffed and advised by former employees of oil and gas companies. A spokesman for the Energy Department said it is working to restore American energy dominance, lower costs, and expand consumer freedom, and that the only special interest the president cares about is the American people. New territory. ConocoPhillips has lobbied for years to be allowed to drill on new parcels of federal land in Alaska, where it is the largest oil producer. Biden approved Willow, the company's massive drilling project on the state's north slope, but moved to restrict access to millions of acres of Arctic wilderness to the delight of environmentalists. On Inauguration Day, Trump signed an executive order to boost production in Alaska. At the White House meeting in March with oil and gas executives, ConocoPhillips CEO Ryan Lance discussed with the president drilling opportunities in the state, according to people familiar with the matter. In June, the Interior Department proposed rescinding Biden restrictions in an area in Alaska known as the National Petroleum Reserve. ConocoPhillips has since applied for federal permits to explore in the reserve, which is also where Willow is located. The announcements have been met with despair by environmentalists who, for years, have fought to shut down fossil fuels exploration and production in the Arctic. A spokesman for ConocoPhillips said the company has been safely and reliably developing Alaska's energy resources for years, including in the National Petroleum Reserve, and that it appreciates the Trump administration's rule changes. While boosting prospects for the oil industry, the Trump administration also has taken steps to pause or halt wind and solar projects. The tax and spending bill ended tax credits, and the Interior Department issued an order last month that will likely make it more difficult to build solar and wind projects on federal lands. Clean energy companies complain that the U.S. risks slowing the delivery of new power needed for the global AI race, ceding to China advances in solar panels, batteries, and electric vehicles. I think it's sad and bad for the U.S. economy, bad for competitiveness, and bad for the environment to be trying desperately to shore up the role of fossil fuels, said John Holdren, a former director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy in the Obama administration and now a Harvard University professor. Trade-offs. During a fundraiser last fall in Midland, Texas, Trump repeated his campaign vow to drill, baby, drill, according to Curtis Leonard, one of the oil executives who attended. Someone in the crowd shot back that oil and gas producers decide whether or not to drill, not the government, Leonard recalled. For years, U.S. shale companies burned cash to fuel growth but returned little or no profits. Investors compelled them to rein in spending, and the publicly traded ones are wary of ramping up development even when oil and gas prices jump. Their inventories of premium wells have been shrinking. Trump has kept pushing for lower crude prices to help tame inflation and achieve his geopolitical goals.
He has repeatedly told oil executives he wants oil under $40 a barrel, and executives have taken turns lobbying him against lower prices. He thinks lower prices solve every problem. It's a magic elixir, one oil executive said. A lot of executives have told him it will actually lead to bankruptcies in the industry and lower production over time. The recent tumble in crude prices has prompted producers to shed drilling rigs and crews that frack wells and added pressure on companies to do more with less. ConocoPhillips last week said it would cut up to a quarter of its workforce. Some of those layoffs were expected after it acquired rival Marathon Oil last year. Chevron announced earlier this year that it would shrink its workforce by up to 20%. The number of oil and gas extraction jobs declined by more than 3% between January and August to its lowest level in 2 years, according to preliminary data by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. In their March meeting with Trump, oil and gas executives lobbied for a carve-out for oil field products from his 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum, but that didn't happen. Permian Basin driller Diamondback Energy reported last month that it expected some well construction costs to increase by nearly 25% this year because of the tariffs, which Trump doubled in June. It said the duties would raise the break-even costs of nearly every well drilled in the U.S. this year. Still, many in the industry said Trump is bestowing so many gifts that a period of lower profit is probably worth the cost. "We all voted for this," said Taylor Sell, chief executive of Texas driller Element Petroleum. Exclusive artificial intelligence. OpenAI backs AI-made animated feature film. The film, called Critters, aims to debut at the Cannes Film Festival and will leverage the startup's AI tools and resources by Jessica Tunkel. OpenAI wants to prove that generative artificial intelligence can make movies faster and cheaper than Hollywood does these days. The startup is lending its tools and computing resources to the creation of a feature-length animated movie made largely with AI that is expected to be released in theaters globally next year. Critters, about forest creatures who go on an adventure after their village is disrupted by a stranger, is the brainchild of Chad Nelson, a creative specialist at OpenAI. Nelson started sketching out the characters 3 years ago while trying to make a short film with what was then OpenAI's new DALL-E image generation tool. Now he has teamed up with production companies in London and Los Angeles, aiming to debut a feature-length version of the film at the Cannes Film Festival in May. The team is attempting to make the movie in about 9 months instead of the 3 years it would typically take, said James Richardson, co-founder of a London-based Vertigo Films. Vertigo is producing the film along with Native Foreign, a studio that specializes in using AI along with traditional video production tools. Critters has a budget of less than $30 million, far less than what animated films typically cost. The production team plans to cast human actors for character voices and hire artists to draw sketches that are fed into OpenAI's tools, including GPT-5 and open image generating models. OpenAI can say what its tools do all day long, but it's much more impactful if someone does it, Nelson said. That's a much better case study today than me building a demo. Entertainment companies, including Disney and Netflix, are experimenting with AI tools for a variety of production, user experience, and marketing work. But many have been wary of a wholesale embrace, in part because they fear upsetting actors and writers whose guilds have fought for protections against tools they say could cost their members work. Entertainment companies have also sought to protect their copyrighted characters and works. In June, Disney and Comcast Universal sued AI provider Midjourney for allegedly making copies of their copyrighted properties. Midjourney has disputed those claims in court filings. Warner Brothers Discovery last week filed a similar lawsuit against Midjourney. The script for Critters was written by some members of the team that wrote Paddington in Peru. Production has begun and casting decisions for the voices of the characters will be made in the next few weeks. It was funded by Vertigo's Paris-based parent company, Federation Studios. The studios involved are developing a compensation model to allow the roughly 30 people working on Critters to share in any profits, Nelson said. OpenAI is betting that if Critters is successful, it will show that AI can deliver content strong enough for the big screen and accelerate Hollywood's adaptation of the technology, Nelson said. OpenAI's tools also lower the cost of entry, allowing more people to make more creative content, he said. An OpenAI spokesman said, "If the film reflects the kind of creativity and exploration we love to encourage, still a box office release of an original animated film is a risky bet, and it's unclear whether audiences already reluctant to go to the multiplex will pay to see it. The companies haven't yet sought a distribution partner. While AI-generated work can't be copyrighted, the film's use of humans to voice the characters and create the art will be fed into AI tools will likely make it eligible for copyright protection," said Nick Klarovov, co-founder of Native Foreign. Nelson and Klarovov initially created Critters as a short-form film that made its debut in 2023 with funding from the AI company, The Wall Street Journal first reported. OpenAI later hired Nelson to be a liaison with creators and artists on how to use its tools. It is unclear whether OpenAI will help with the film's marketing. Richardson said it was too early to talk about the marketing plans. "I have never been in this position in my life where we are starting a movie and I have no idea about to happen," Richardson recalled telling OpenAI executives. "It's a very ambitious, massive experiment." This brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.